I'm Leah Simone Bowen, the host of Podcast Playlist on CBC. We're a podcast discovery show, and we love a great story. So each week, we highlight the podcasts we think you should check out.
The show is a classic.
Love how they select their topics.
It's great.
And from time to time, we're joined by some of the biggest names in podcasting.
My name is Jamie Loftus.
John Green.
I'm Michael Hobbs.
My name is Nicole Byer, and I have a podcast recommendation.
You can find Podcast Playlist on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
It's not every day you're doing an interview with a professional musician, a successful one, and they look at you and go, "Tom, I regret being a professional musician and I wouldn't recommend it to anybody." Owen Pallett is honest about the realities of being a musician in 2023. They're releasing some of the albums they made as Final Fantasy, which were some of the most critically acclaimed albums in Canadian history. And they'll be here to talk about their journey and, yeah, the realities of being a musician. That's coming up. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. So let me start out with an image here on a Monday. When you first see Owen Pallett standing on stage, they're up there by themselves with their violin, and you think, what is this going to be, like a recital or something like that? But next thing you know, stuff starts happening. Owen taps the microphone and loops it, and it becomes a beat. Owen plays a really low note on the violin, loops it, it becomes the bass. Owen plays high notes, and it becomes almost like a symphony coming from one person. It takes a remarkable musician to make music like that by yourself. And Owen is one. Just take a listen.
Hey, Timothy, I wish for clairvoyance. I want to see my wife and kids and how I would live, how I would die.
So let's do some accolades here. Owen was the winner of the very first Polaris Music Prize, the award for Best Canadian Album. That was back in 2006. They've worked with artists like Taylor Swift, Ed Sheeran, The Hidden Cameras, Lito Pimienta. I mean, you ask anybody in this country, they'll tell you Owen Pallett has had a remarkable career, an enviable career even in music. So yeah, why is Owen telling people that they regret it, that they wouldn't recommend a career in music to anybody? Owen just released remastered versions of their early records as Final Fantasy, Has a Good Home, and He Poos Clouds. That's what brought them into the studio. And we talk a little bit about their journey in music, how a classical nerd becomes the darling of indie rock, and yeah, the realities of being an actual musician. Here's my conversation with Owen Pallett. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me, Tom.
Nice to have you here. Last time we talked, I remember, I think I had a mental breakdown the last time we talked.
Really?
Yeah, because it was like early pandemic days and we were doing it over Zoom, like early Zoom.
I was definitely in a bit of a state of, I wouldn't call it mania, but it was something insane. Like I was, yeah, the early lockdown was wild.
I'm glad you're here.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
I thought what we could do is go back a little bit because I've never really got a chance to do this with you. What music was playing around the house when you were growing up?
My father is an organist, and so I would be, quote unquote, treated to an hour a day of him practicing, you know, various pieces of music. Sometimes it would just be stuff he'd be learning for church, and other times it would be, you know, Max Reger or, you know, Vidor or Messiaen, you know, some difficult stuff. And
that's the second time Messiaen has come up on the show this week, by the way. Isn't that weird?
Well, you know, he's due a resurgence,
you know. Sorry, you were saying, so he was practicing, your dad was practicing a lot around the house.
Yeah, and also just playing classical music. And in my mom's house, you know, I mean, I grew up with just a pile of records and I was really exposed mostly to classical music at a young age. You know, like when I had my first Sony Walkman, I had Bartok music for strings, percussion, and celeste on repeat in it, like, and Bach double violin concerto, you know, some pretty stuff, I guess, maybe for a 5-6 year old.
What was the music then that became like your own? Like, what was the mind shattering music for you?
The real moment of like the brain terraforming experience that I had was when I was five. I broke my leg, and I like to say I broke it in a car accident, but it's actually me and my brother were roughhousing in the car before we were about to go to the zoo on July 1st.
So the car wasn't even moving.
No. Oh, no. We were waiting for my mom, and we were supposed to go to the zoo that day. It was Canada Day, and we were going to go to the zoo, and we were roughhousing in the car, and it wasn't my brother's fault at all. It just happened, but I broke my leg. And so I had to spend 6 weeks in a wheelchair. And my godfather, who was also my great uncle, and I was very, very close to him. He was a really wonderful man. He kind of took pity on me and brought over the most exorbitant luxury that you could ever imagine in the mid-80s, which was a VCR. And he brought over these VHS tapes of movies that he thought I would like. He brought three of them, and this is a big deal. At the time, the VHSs, they were in these kind of molded plastic large cases.
Yeah, you know,
like
I remember.
Big cases, not like the smaller ones that Disney stuff was getting in. They were big. And he brought over The Wizard of Oz and Time Bandits and 2001, A Space Odyssey. So I watched over those 6 weeks those movies over and over and over again to the point that they're just like emblazoned in my brain. I could probably recite to you Time Bandits from start to finish right now. But the most importantly was in 2001 was just there's Khachaturian, there's, you know, all the Johann Strauss waltzes. Most importantly, though, there's all those Ligeti pieces, the famous the Requiem's in there, I think Lontano's in there, and Atmospheres. So, you know, 5 years old, kind of like having this almost Clockwork Orange exposure moment to Ligeti was really intense. but yeah, he's kind of like just that was like really year zero for my musical interests.
No pop music?
No, I mean, I like had a Eurythmics tape when I was 6 years old, and I like got into Billy Idol for a period of time.
But like even your teenage years?
It was, well, I think age 10, I got into top 40, you know, and I was taping songs off the radio. I got into rap for a while. I had Digital Underground, Sex Packets, and had to hide it from my parents. I think my stepfather heard Humpty Dance at one point and was like, what are you listening to? Because I was 10 and listening to Humpty Dance.
Yeah.
It's pretty, pretty wild. But yeah, I mean, as a teenager, I, you know, got into, you know, the basic Gay Boy starter pack of, you know, Bjork and Tori Amos and, you know, Lisa Germano and stuff like that.
Were you a gifted violinist from the beginning?
It's interesting you should ask that because I'm an extremely flawed violinist. I had a wonderful teacher for a long, long time. And I was kind of her star pupil, but because I was with the same teacher for a long period of time, I developed certain technical deficiencies that she just wasn't correcting. And none of the other teachers wanted to take me because they didn't want to steal me away from them. So by the time I was 17, 18 and applying to university performance programs, I was playing top list concertos, you know, I was ready to do it, except my vibrato was sideways and my bow arm was all wrong. And it wasn't really my teacher's fault. It was just the fact that I'd been taught by the same teacher since I was 3 years old. And I remember the head of the performance program at University of Toronto, a really terrible, awful person whose name I won't mention. He laughed in my face and laughed at the fact that, you know, I'd been with the same teacher and made some reference to a movie that I don't remember, but it was pretty humiliating. In those first couple of years that I was doing music composition, because my interest really was to go into music composition, I took applied music with an excellent teacher named Mark Wells, and Mark corrected my bow arm, but we were never able to correct my vibrato.
So you did get into music school. You did get
I
into...
I did. Yeah. Well, I was always interested more in composition than being a violinist, but I did want to be a competent violinist, but my vibrato is just, I've tried to correct it so many times over the years. And I actually just 2 years ago had a violinist, a wonderful violist named Aurelian, who's from Chicago, he just said, if it's working for you, just stick with it.
Yeah.
So I've given up on trying to correct my vibrato.
When you say it was going sideways, do you mean that like it was instead of going like that, you were doing like guitar vibrato?
In a way, yeah. It's like if you imagine that, you know, that I'm making a limp wrist motion.
Yeah.
That's like flapping my flipper. That is the correct vibrato you're supposed to, but I'm doing a torsional kind of almost shaking the violin kind of move.
Right.
Which is a vibrato of sorts. And it's something I've just kind of come to accept as being my sound. Much like my reedy nasal voice.
Are you, because I wondered, was there any path to you? Because it's interesting, you don't meet many like you, people who have made a career out of being a solo. I mean, I don't even know what to call you, but like to have the violin as your sort of main component of your musical offering. Was there any path for you being a symphonic player? Was there any path that you were going to join the TSO, or that was your goal to join some kind of symphony?
I think across the board, every educator that I encountered kind of had a very glass half empty, glass half full sort of view. There were certain people who saw me with some tutelage, some corrections, I could be a superstar player, and others who were just like, get out of here and go back to Mississauga. So, you know, but I found it incredibly discouraging because of this aforementioned performance professor at University of Toronto, who I had been interacting with through Toronto Symphony Youth Orchestra. You know, he was an awful man, and it just discouraged me from kind of really getting into performance at all.
Not the first story I've heard like that. You know, I came up sort of tangentially associated with that, but like because I did a folklore program and a music history program, I found that the percussionists were the coolest people to hang out with, the classical percussionists, like they were the fun people. Mm-hmm. I grew up going to music school, but not necessarily going to that. And man,
I'm not talking about Mark Feuer, by the way.
Oh, I know you're not talking about Mark Feuer.
I'm just like, I hope you don't think that I'm insulting your brother.
No. But it's more that it's not uncommon to hear a story like that.
Well, Mark Feuer was actually fantastic.
Mark's incredible.
He's amazing. And had I been studying with him, it would be a completely different story.
But. So when does the thing happen, though? When does the biopic of the Owen Pallett life, frustrated, people criticizing your technique, not sure where this is going to work out, you want to do composition, where does the Final Fantasy thing happen? Like, well, I'm going to stand on stage and start looping violin. Like, where does that start?
It was actually, I can actually pinpoint the exact moment that it happened, because from basically when I was 18 years old, my stepfather, I found in the attic of my parents' house, my stepfather's old guitar. It was a beautiful guitar. It was a... for people who know guitars, it was a Mahogany O Series Martin. It was a beautiful, tiny, small guitar, and it was in terrible shape. But I got it fixed up, and I learned how to play on it, and I was writing songs on it. And I was basically just doing all manner of stuff. I was playing in bands. I was playing the kind of bands that would play in bars. You know, I was joined the Hidden Cameras, and I was suddenly playing in bands that would be signed to labels, you know.
Not playing violin.
Oh, yeah, I played violin.
Okay.
I was doing all sorts of stuff. But really the moment that there was a kind of almost a eureka moment, because I just had borrowed a loop station from, I think it was Matt Smith, having seen Matt's doing looping, having seen a guitarist in Toronto, Craig Dunsmuir, doing guitar looping with, then it was Guitarchestra. I had seen Craig Dunsmuir 20 years ago doing guitar looping, and so I borrowed this loop station, and I prepared just a set of, I think, four songs and played them at Sneaky D's as part of this kind of larger tribute night. And my boyfriend at the time just came up to me, and he was a wonderful boyfriend, but he never said anything kind to me. And he came up, and his eyes were wide, and he just said, that is what you should be doing. You need to do a lot of that. So that's what started it.
That's beautiful to have that sort of crystallized moment. In that moment, are you going like, all right, this is going to be my career. This is what I'm going to do. I'm not going to do education. I'm not going to apply to a university. This is what I'm going to do.
Well, I mean, at that time, this would have been 2004. I was still playing a lot of bands, and I started doing the Final Fantasy shows around Toronto. And I mean, it's maybe a story that I've told before even to you, but... I was starving. Like, I was starving. I was living off of a can of beans, you know, that I get.
No, you never told me that before.
Yeah, I was having a really, really hard year because I had been working in the service industry and I was trying to do other things and I was trying to just play in bands and use that to pay the bills because I was playing in Picastro and I was playing with Jim Guthrie Band and I was playing with the Hidden Cameras and I just was starving. And I remember I played a show at Cinecycle. And Stuart McLean was there and he came up to me afterwards and was like, that was amazing. Like, you know, how did you do that? And he was immediately wanting to get me on the show and stuff like this. And he said to me, you know, he said, so what's going on? Like, what do you do for work? What else is up? You know? And I started crying in front of him. I said, I'm actually desperately in need of a job and money. I am so broke. And he hired me. I mean, I had to go through an auditing process.
You worked here? You worked at the...
Yeah, I was music producer for Vinyl Cafe.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, for the 2004-2005 season. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. In fact, Julie Penner...
Another great violinist.
She emailed me knowing I was working for Stuart and like maybe the day, my last day on the job or something like that. Like it had been established that I was leaving because I was doing all this Arcade Fire stuff now.
Yeah.
And she was just like, do you know of any jobs that I can get at CBC? I'm like, take my job, Julie. And she worked on Vinyl Cafe until it ended. Yeah.
Why were you Final Fantasy and not Owen Pallett?
It just didn't seem like I wanted to apply my name to any one project because I had so many other things going on. I was playing in a band, Les Mouches. I had all these other little projects that kind of never came to fruition, like a band with Steve Cato called Internet and a band with my friend Alex called King Tut. And I don't think we ever rehearsed and another solo project called Tenderizer and all this kind of stuff. So Final Fantasy at the time was just one of many different kind of things that I was trying out.
Because of the game? Is that the name because of the video game?
It was named, maybe I'll just take the moment to correct this because it's like, Everyone thinks that I'm a big Final Fantasy fan or something like that.
Yeah.
And I'm a pretty below average in terms of my fandom of the series, but I have played them. I named it that because I was rehearsing in the basement and it was in the basement that we would go downstairs and play hours upon hours of Grand Theft Auto 3 or yeah. hours upon hours of Final Fantasy 10. And it was like a joke. Like I'm going downstairs to play Final Fantasy, you know, when I was going downstairs to make music. So that was the origin of naming my project that, yeah.
I love that so much. Let's listen to something. Take a listen to this. Speaking with Owen Pallett, that's a little of their debut album is Final Fantasy. None of you will ever see a penny. What's going through your mind when you're listening to that just right now?
That song?
Yeah, like what you're listening to the recording of it.
Oh, my voice. My voice sounds better than I remember.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice.
Yeah. Yeah, that record was, you know, we made that record so quickly. Like I was going to be supporting Arcade Fire on their North American tour and I needed to have something to sell because otherwise, you know, I mean, it was a big part of it, right?
Yeah. So
CDs would sell when you had them at your show. So me and Leon Tahani just spent 6 days doing nothing but record, like not even sleeping. And yeah, it's all a blur at this point.
As I mentioned earlier, He Poos Clouds, it takes home the first ever Polaris Music Prize, which for people who may not be as familiar with it, is the album of the year in Canada. Based entirely on, artistic merit, not on genre or sales. What do you remember about that?
It was a surprise. I'm still kind of surprised when I think back that record beat like Twin Cinema or, you know, Apologies, Queen Mary, like records I really love, you know, and I didn't think that I was the only person who actually thought that I was going to win. It was Stephen Himmelfarb, my booking agent. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was a surprise back then. But the thing is that's kind of interesting, is nobody really knew what this award was or what we could expect of it because it was really the first year. All we knew about it was that Rogers was giving us $20,000. And that was definitely, you know, as dark as it was appealing.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, I like I said, I didn't have a lot of money. You know, Rogers was the company that I basically was on the phone to every couple of months, screaming at them that I didn't care about the credit rating. I wasn't going to pay their exorbitant bills. You know, it's like, you think I'll ever own a house, Rogers Wireless? I don't care. You can threaten me with assaults against my credit rating all you want.
And then months later, you're like,
months later, they're like, oh, we want to give you an award. I was just kind of like, from Rogers? No. So yeah, it was kind of confusing at the time, you know, and it was interesting too, because, you know, we had the ceremony, it was a big party, and it wasn't written about the next day. Like, there was no coverage in any papers. They didn't mention it, because it was just this new thing. You know, it kind of took some time to kind of build up steam, you know, for it to actually be recognized as an award. So, yeah, people have, over the years, have said, like, how much did winning the Polaris Award, you know, affect your career trajectory? And I have to admit, not a lot. You know, it wasn't a big deal when I won it. I gave all the money away.
You owed people money, or you gave it away?
No, I gave it away. I mean, I gave half of it. I gave to people who had made Heepus Clouds with me, because and I had paid them, but I just felt like this is a record we all made together. So I gave some to Leon and some to the string quartet. And there, half it, I guess you could say, stayed in the family, because I gave it to my boyfriend to pay off his student loans. And then the last part of it I gave to a band to help finance a band I really like, to help them pay for the recording of their first album, which they recorded, and it's a great album, and they never put it out.
Oh no, I was just about to ask, is it, you know, what, you know?
I don't know if I've ever made it public about what band it was, but yeah, they never put out the record, and it's too bad. I still have it on my iTunes, and yeah, it's a great record. I listen to it all the time.
If you are that band that Owen's talking about there, let us know. q@cbc.ca. That's my version of like a true crime podcast. That is the first part of my conversation with Owen Pallett. They have put out deluxe remasters of their first two albums and a couple of EPs. Let's play a little music from that Polaris Prize winning album. This is the title track, He Poos Clouds.
And I can't feel it. But hey, hey, all the boys I have ever loved have been digital. I've been a guest on a screen or in a book. I move him with my thumbs. I move him with my thumbs. I write his name in nothing. He whispers to the author that I will be the only one. Escape, escape. It's time for real.
That's Owen Pallett and He Poos Clouds, the record that won them the inaugural Polaris Music Prize and led to a very successful music career. So why is Owen saying they wouldn't recommend a music career to anybody? You'll find out after this.
Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts. This is the last time I'm asking you this. Put my name on.
John Power. You're listening to Q. You're in the middle of my conversation with the Grammy-winning Canadian musician Owen Pallett. So why are we listening to Taylor Swift right now, you might ask? Well, the strings you're listening to right now. Austin, just turn this up for a second. You can hear the strings there a little bit in the background, right? The strings and the string arrangements all over Taylor Swift's Red album were arranged by Owen Pallett. Taylor is just one of the many pop stars that Owen's worked with. Ed Sheeran, Duran Duran, Robbie Williams, Lana Del Rey. It's a big part of their work. And it's a big part of the reality of being an actual working musician, of making money as a working musician, something we talk about later in this conversation. Owen gets really honest about why they actually wouldn't recommend life as a musician. But we start out by talking about these pop music gigs. Here's more of my conversation with Owen Pallett. Do you like doing that kind of work? Like the, I mean, you did the Taylor Swift record, one of the Taylor Swift records?
Yeah, I worked on Red, not the new version, although they used my arrangement on it.
Orchestrating?
It was an orchestral arrangement. And for the original version, I was down in LA conducting the orchestra too. The new version, I never remember this guy's name and I got to remember it because he's so good. But he's the violinist who plays with Goldfrapp. He's been working with Jack Knife Lee, who's the producer who redid his production on the new one. So he, I don't know if it was him or Aaron, but they got the Goldfrapp guy in to basically recreate my arrangement.
Because it's interesting. I was talking to a friend of mine who he told me he sang the background vocals on "Levitating" by Dua Lipa.
Oh wow!
And I said, what was she like? And he goes, I didn't meet her.
Yeah.
And I said, did you ever meet her? He goes, no. And I said, if she was in the room right now, would you go over and say, hey, I sang background vocals in your biggest song? He went, nah, probably not.
Yeah, I think wasn't it Drew Drekka did the strings on that?
Drew Drekka did do the strings for that. Yeah, yeah.
I don't
There's
know
a lot
ever
of
met
big
her.
Pop stars getting their strings orchestrated out of Toronto right now between you and Drew Drekka.
Yeah, well, and Rob Moose, you know.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, Rob Moose is not out of Toronto, but
in New York.
Yeah, he did the new Miley as well.
Do you like doing that kind of work, the big pop star orchestral work?
Yeah, I love it. It's so fun. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because it's really rare when I actually meet and hang out with or even become friends with, you know, some of these clients. But
clients.
Yeah. Clients. I love it.
So all this orchestrating, all the touring, a lot of critical acclaim, nominated for an Oscar. And then I read, my experience with taking something I love, which is making music, and turning it into my job has been the biggest mistake of my life.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Yeah, I always say this to people, anyone who, like, the number of people where I've been confronted with seeing what they do musically, and I felt compelled to tell them you should do this for a living, has been limited to maybe one or two people in my entire life.
Why?
And one of them was Grimes, actually.
You saw Grimes and you were like, you should think about doing this?
Yeah, I was, because Rolly Pemberton, actually, and I were in South by Southwest, and he's like, you got to see my friend Claire, she's amazing. And we went to some barbecue, and Claire was playing, and there was nobody there, and she was amazing. And, you know, I felt compelled afterwards. I was like, I never say this, but you should do this as a career.
Why are you feeling this
way?
So
you can blame me. Yeah, for everything that happened afterwards.
Don't check your DMs. what's going on? Why are you feeling this way?
Oh, it's just, there's really nothing that contributes to, that saps all the joy out of something that is really meant to be fun, is really meant to be social, than having to rely upon it as your source of income. You know, most of the musicians, especially in Toronto, the musicians who I idolize, who I love, these are not full-time musicians. These are people who, yeah, who they are full-time musicians, but they're not, you know, quote unquote professional musicians. They have a job. They do a thing, you know, they pay their bills in other ways. And I've just, I don't even remember when it was. I think it was 2006 when I was making Hebrews Clouds. I started every time I was working on music, I was crying. It was just really hard. I was like, because I had just had the pressure of like, this is now how I pay my bills. I've got to, you know, do this and pay my rent with it. And it became such a stressful activity. Yeah. So I don't encourage anyone to move into music, especially not now, you know, now that it's not even an industry anymore.
I mean, is that what you're saying? Are you saying that it's not a good time to get, sorry, one should not get into music because in 2023, it is impossible to make any money from it, which is a compelling point. Or one should not make music their career because it saps the joy out of this beautiful thing.
Both. And when I'm saying this, I'm just saying don't make it your career. That's
really
well. Also, when you think about it, too, in historically the role of music in society, it has not been in the model of, like, you know, what Adorno would call the culture industry. It's been something you do with your family. It's been something you do in your community. It's been a social act. It's been a cultural act, you know, not an industry act. And, you know, I mean, I see people online screaming about, you know, Spotify pirating all of our profits away. And, you know, there's a part of me that, you know, I extremely would love to see Daniel Ek flayed alive. You know, I make no secret of it that, you know, I don't care if this means that I'm going to be on some no-fly list. Like, just so you know where I stand with regards to Spotify. At the same time, I'm just sitting here being like, recorded music has been something that we've been able to capitalize upon for, what, the last 100, 125 years?
Yeah.
And prior to this, it wasn't that model, you know? It feels like it was that what we're seeing is like kind of like the death of vaudeville.
But there's so much. I'm so glad you mentioned that because I talk about this a lot. When I hear people talk about, you know, how do I say this? Because I don't want to. There's so many great. I mean, you were right. It is a mortal sin that friends of mine who make some of the greatest music ever can't rely on CD sales, can't rely on album sales anymore. That bums me out. It bums me out. I really wish they could. Some of my friends are unable to make the music and art that they want to make because of it, you know, or they can't put all their time into it. And when people say, you know, they're nostalgic for, you know, but there was a time, but like, it's a very short time. It was a very, very short period of about 60, 70 years where people were able to become millionaires based on album sales, based on CD sales. It's very, 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 I mean, before that it was social music or you were employed by the court, you know, it's relatively recent.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. It's like as much, and I get in fights with people about this because I do think Spotify as a platform is the ideal. I think it's the ideal.
Really?
It's like, yeah, I'm old enough to read about a band from Germany called Neu and have no way of hearing them. I could not hear what Neu sounded like. You know the band I'm talking
about.
Yes,
I do.
Yeah. So, and I remember going to used record stores, asking them, where can I hear this band that I've heard so much about and I want to hear what Neu sounds like? Because there was literally no way you could listen to what this band sounds like. And eventually down at Neurotica Records, they got in these $30 bootleg CDs. Like they were CDRs. So you could buy a $30 CDR of Neu's first album. And I did. And I bought it and
a
I brought it home.
CD.
A burned CD for $30 of this record. And it's like now everybody knows what noise sounds like. We know what noise sounds like, you know. But there was a period where access to recorded music was so restricted and was so hard to come by it. And now it's like I look at CDs as like almost like this, like really like this garbage, you know, poorly considered, poorly constructed product, you know, so easily scratched, doesn't play anymore. You know, it's like, it seems so antiquated. I love the format of that Spotify is offering. It just, as far as I'm concerned, it's, you know, they're pirates and they're stealing from us. But I'm more thinking like, should anybody even be making money off recorded material in the first place, you know?
So how do you get up in the morning and make eggs and start making music now?
Drink a lot of coffee. I have a coffee addiction, you know.
How do you wake up every day? And now that you're feeling this way, you still, as far as I know, as far as I know, this is still your job. This is still your life.
Because I still love what I do. Like I still love the moment, the creative moment of making music. I love coming up with something new. I love recording it. I love sending it to whatever its purpose is, whether it's a new song, I like sending it to my friends. If it's a cue for a movie, I like sending it to the director. It's like, if it's an arrangement for a client, I love sending it to the client. Like I always take joy in the act of the music making. It's just having to rely upon it for an income, imbues it with a kind of a chaos.
John Prine, I can't believe I get to say this. John Prine said to me one time, he said, you know, I really liked writing songs until I had to write songs.
Exactly. That's exactly. Yeah. See, this is why John Prine is a great songwriter. And I have to make these convoluted fantasy epic things.
here's something I thought, well, listen, I'm happy you're making music. I'm happy you're still making music and I'm happy this stuff came out. And I always love talking to you. Owen, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
That was my conversation with Owen Pallett. The deluxe remastered versions of their first two albums and EPs as Final Fantasy are out now.
She drives a little white car to the seminar on modern romance. Possible, possible ideas for a date include a shooting range and a justice ball to bursting with thoughts of an evening. Nobody, nobody, nobody will ever know her longing. She's got a heart that'll never melt. She's got a heart that'll never, never melt.
That is it for us today. The other episode that's out today from Q is my conversation with the author Emma Grove. It's a pretty amazing story, and I'm grateful that Emma told it to us. It's about her experience going to a therapist, showing up every week as a different person, eventually being diagnosed with dissociative identity disorder, what used to be called multiple personality disorder, how writing the book was so hard, and what made it worth it. So check out that conversation. Check out the book, but check out that conversation wherever you got this podcast. I'm Tom Power. We'll see you soon, later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.